The Tom Woods Show, episode 2095.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined today by Connor Mortel, who is a student at the business school at Florida State University. And as we've seen over the years, business schools have been probably, out of all the institutions in academia, the most receptive to the ideas of the Austrian School of Economics, more so possibly even than economics departments. And we've seen a good number of Austrian scholars really flourishing as professors in business schools and having a good collegial kind of relationship with their fellow faculty members. But all is not 100% perfect. And even in the business schools, there can be problems. And that's even before we get into the corporate social responsibility stuff and, you know, maybe the little bit of wokeism creeping in. We're not even at that level. I want to talk more theoretical sorts of problems with Connor. First of all, Connor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I could not be more excited to be here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So how many years have you been in this program? And how long is the program?
So I've been doing a more part-time program because I still work full-time. So as a result, the program is closer to 3 years rather than a standard one or two for an MBA program. I am 2 years into it. All goes well, knock on wood, I should be graduating this coming December. So that's about where I stand in the program currently.
Okay, good, good, good. All right, and you're at Florida State. So I don't know anything about the business school at Florida State. I know, as you mentioned to me, that the economics department has Randy Holcomb, who's a good guy, and I think I've had him as a guest on the show in the past. But I don't know anything specifically about Florida State, which in a way makes it a good example, because that means that, you know, I don't know that there are any Austrian superstars who either are there or are friends with anybody there. So we can treat it as kind of a standard business school program. Now, I'm sure it has its good points and its bad points, but surely you've found some merit in the program. So what would you say are valuable things? Are there valuable things that you've picked up that other people could, you know, even if they're not specifically Austrian insights, that the world would be a better place if other people knew them?
So I most certainly think there are valuable things at the school. Judging by my human action, I wouldn't still be attending the school if I didn't think that. I love my Noles. I love FSU. I don't want any of my criticism to sound too harsh on them, because I think anything I'm complaining about is kind of what you said, more on a standard problem with business schools across the board. I don't think it's anything they've done uniquely incorrectly by any means. First and foremost, as goofy as it sounds, one thing that I am grateful for is that I'm going out into the world. And at the end of the day, MBA are three magic letters. Even if I had not learned anything, for whatever reason, I'm deemed more credited and more knowledgeable simply by putting those on my resume. And I have to be grateful that FSU has given me that opportunity to put those three magic letters on my resume in and of itself. Additionally, when I first reached out to the program, I had formerly worked for the Florida House of Representatives, and it made sense to apply to FSU because I was living in Tallahassee full-time at the time I was applying, because it was during session. And as critical as I may be about certain things, there is a fairly substantial network at Florida State, especially in the world of Florida politics. I've since left that particular world, but no matter what you do, if you're working in business, you're in some way, shape, or form going to be regulated or affected by the government. And having these connections who are really going unbelievable places in the world of politics has been incredible, kind of watching some of my classmates, even just in these few years, grow, and seeing some former alumni who are just a couple years older than me start to take off in that world. So there's absolutely value, because like I said, I wouldn't still be here if I didn't believe that.
I want to talk about a short piece you wrote over at Mises.org related to one of the insights that you've had while at business school. And it had to do with the role of profits and the role of managers And you were talking about a lesson that was teaching that any given manager has four levels of responsibility. And what was very revealing was what the lowest of those responsibilities was said to be and what the highest responsibility was said to be.
Yes, absolutely. So I had originally written that. If I'm being honest, I didn't even write that to send to the Mises Institute. I've written several things for them before. I wrote that because I was sitting there with this assignment I'd been faced with, and I was so frustrated with how incorrect I found it to be that I just had to put something on paper, and I ended up sending it their way because I liked it. But effectively, like you said, the lowest responsibility, as I'd been taught in my business school, was to simply just get by and earn a profit and be just this greedy old businessman just making money. And the highest responsibility of the manager or the entrepreneur was to create social value rather than simply earn profits. And then the middle responsibilities that it offered, which I didn't get into in the article, were the second one was to, you know, make your employees happy. And the third one was to make your customers happy. And I remembered looking at it and saying, that's simply not how it works at all. Making profit isn't a magic button we can just press and say, okay, this is the profit button. Or as Austrians, we know that value isn't determined by cost. I can't just charge up some ridiculous thing and say, oh, because there was all this labor, I can charge this much for it and exploit this profit from you. Profit comes from creating a value. That lowest level and that highest level are in and of themselves the same concept. You are not going to simply muddle by making profits without creating value for the people purchasing your goods or services. And as a result, I saw that and I just, like I'd kind of said to you previously, I almost thought about writing something where I thought, oh, your Facebook friends are wrong about business school. Like, yes, business school has been an ally to people like us in many ways. You see great things like, I know Peter Klein with the Mises Institute, for how much it kills me as a TCU fan, he is a teacher at Baylor University and he's in their entrepreneurship program and he does great things. Per Bylund does phenomenal things at Oklahoma State's entrepreneurship program. We see all this where there are business schools that have been very allied to us, but it jumped at me that it's still, regardless of how good they've been to us in many ways, lots of programs, and especially these MBA-specific programs, are still teaching flawed economics in the underlying lessons they're teaching. One of these great ones was that it's even possible to create a profit without creating value.
This is particularly discouraging to see at a business school, because this is the conventional wisdom about what profits are. We barely want to speak about them. They're somehow not really honorable, that instead what we need is the business to do X, Y, and Z that have really nothing to do with their core mission. I mean, if you as an individual want to contribute to various social causes, nothing's stopping you. But the role of the business is to provide goods and services for people. That's what the role is. And then if you become rich through that business, you can take your own money and donate it to whatever you want. But the way I've been putting it lately is, just think of it this way. Let's suppose there weren't business firms making, toasters for people. There were no businesses. If my business stops making toasters, all other businesses stop making toasters. If you wanted to toast something, well, okay, let's suppose you couldn't just have an open flame and do it. Let's suppose you had to have a toaster. Could you imagine the expense and the time involved making your own toaster? Which, by the way, there's a guy who did a TED Talk who did this, and he went around and gathered all the materials, and it's unthinkable the work that you would have to do outside the division of labor to put that toaster together. Then you put it together, it barely works, it probably gets set on fire, whereas thanks to the fact that we have business firms creating toasters, you can get a toaster, you know, down the street for $10. $10, which is like, what is that, like an hour of your work time if you're earning minimum wage? 1 hour. It would take you a year probably to make a toaster. So the difference between a year and an hour is the gain to you from the existence of that business. But we're not taught that. We're taught all these things about the wickedness of profits. And what's more, the idea that a business school would not be teaching that what you students are about to go do is deeply and profoundly honorable and moral. Have you encountered anything like that so far?
You know, I have not encountered anything even close to it being deeply and profoundly moral. I mean, what you're just talking about there reminds me a lot of Leonard Reed's I, Pencil, where he talks about how impossible it would be to make something as simple as a pencil and profits bring us all together like that. I have never been taught anything even remotely close to it being an honorable good. And in fact, the other thing I'll go as far as to say is the class I'm taking right now that actually brought up these four levels of what an entrepreneur or a manager should be doing, I've taken business ethics classes throughout the course of this. And for as much as it kills me in the business ethics class, hearing the guy saying, well, you know, we should strive for higher goals, I understand that the average person is not you or I. They're probably not thinking of the world the way we do, despite the fact that, like you said, what we're doing is profoundly moral in doing the world a service. But I can at least see where, from a different perspective, you might come to that. But to take it a step further, this is a marketing class that I'm taking that brought this up. This isn't even, it's not a discussion of whether or not it's moral here. It is the underlying foundation that we are in this class. We want to market a product for whatever reason. You're here because you want to study marketing. You've clearly created something that you believe has some kind of value. Otherwise, you wouldn't want to market it. And yet instead, they're saying, well, you created this, but if this doesn't also do X, Y, and Z for the community, how has it even created value at all? And that's 10 steps removed from reality of any good that anyone's creating if they're out there marketing and really believe in what they're doing there.
So tell me about, you're the one who's at the school. I'm the one who's comfortably sitting in his office listening to you tell me about all the problems. So you have the details that I don't have. What's something else that you've noticed that either is a gross outrage or is a subtle theoretical problem?
So as far as a gross outrage goes, I'd probably talk about kind of a lack of discussion of trade-offs we see that occurs in most of my business school classes. Trade-offs are, I mean, to you and I as economists, probably one of the most important things there are to discuss. But then even a step further, as a business person, you think, you know, so prior to working where I do now and working with the state, I had worked for a restaurant and my local municipality banned plastic straws. And we had to decide whether or not to buy paper straws, 80% plastic straws, rubber straws, metal straws, whatever it may be. And at the end of the day, we talk about, you see in these business classes, anytime you talk about trade-offs, you're talking about an investment. We've decided to purchase a new property. Here are the credit information. Here's this, which property will produce more profit. But as a real business person, there's a trade-off every day of which straw do I buy? And not just which one costs the least and will do the best for me, but which one my consumer doesn't want a paper straw that dissolves in their mouth. Maybe I should go for the metal straw because it'll be something else. And if even the straw decision has all these ripple effects of which consumers will actually come to your service, it's ridiculous to assume that these trade-off discussions really only occur at some deeply formulaic math question of building a new property or whatnot, because the trade-offs occur much lower. And then to answer your other portion as a more subtle thing that I may, as an Austrian, probably be more irritated by than others, is that we don't really discuss business cycles much at all within the program. We all are aware that recessions exist, but whenever you're sitting there up at 2 a.m. doing your master's degree project, working on something, every project you're assigned kind of just lives in its own bubble. Business cycles aren't discussed at all. And what I've said, I shot you an email mentioning, was that I might understand if they were out there teaching some poor business cycle theory, I'd probably be irritated as the Austrian I am, but I'd see where they came from. But it's really something that isn't discussed in the slightest. And we can say that that's an economics issue and not a business school issue, but it's the businesses who have to operate within these cycles. It's, as Austrians, we see the boom bust cycle as entrepreneurs making malinvestments because of misleading credit information. If our entrepreneurs understood it better, we could see better investment during those times and, you know, we could see a whole better world possibly. And then you see on the flip side, the Austrian school has people like Murray Sabrin, who wrote his book, Navigating the Boom Bust Cycle, which doesn't even, I mean, it touches on what exactly the boom bust cycle is, but it kind of says, look, you've got a gist of it. You understand how it works. Here's how you as a businessman should be looking to operate your business. Here's the signs that maybe you need to start calming down on your long-term projects. Here's the signs that ramp up. And that's kind of the thing I'd like to see taught in business schools, where you understand business cycles and you say, look, as a business person, these are going to happen. How are you going to react when they do?
I had Mariana talk about that book, as a matter of fact. Maybe I'll put that as an episode. I'll put it on the show notes page also. Our show notes page for this episode is tomwoods.com/2095. I'm going to link to Murray's book there and also to the interview I did with him about it, because it really is one of very few books, really, if any, that actually try to say to the businessman, the Federal Reserve is going to be throwing white noise into your good faith attempts to try to figure out what you should be doing, you know, because it's going to be fiddling with interest rates and making your calculations all wrong. And so here are some signs that that's getting particularly intense, or here are sorts of things you ought to do under certain circumstances. It's a really, really great foray into a largely uncharted area. And it would be a perfect book to introduce into business schools. And of course, Murray taught at a business school. But if you're not going to talk about the business cycle at all, or the role of the Fed in entrepreneurial calculation, then of course it has no role. And incidentally, it seems to me that the typical economics textbook has almost nothing to say about business cycles. It's almost as if they've just given up trying to figure out what causes them. So that is a major absence, I would say, in a business school. They should at least have competing theories. And how should the entrepreneur navigate these different scenarios? Supposing this theory is correct, what does this mean for the entrepreneur? Supposing that theory is correct, what does this mean? But it doesn't even get raised. So that definitely is a problem. Hey, everybody, just a quick word about healthcare. You know as well as I do, your healthcare is no longer something that takes place between you and your doctor. Government and big insurance companies stand between you and quality care. Lobbyists are fighting to make sure they won't have competition and you won't have options. But CrowdHealth's disruptive technology puts your healthcare decisions back in your hands, saving you money and cutting out the middlemen. It's not insurance. It's what insurance should be. And there are no deductibles, networks, complicated exclusions, or copays. You see, any doctor you want, pay the first $500, submit any bills from there. The CrowdHealth community takes care of the rest. You pay one low monthly total to fund your account. That's less than $200 a month for most people. 100% of your monthly contribution directly funds and reduces the healthcare costs of the community. CrowdHealth helps members shop for great care at a fair price, makes payments to doctors and members as quickly as possible, and negotiates on the community's behalf when unexpected bills arise. So it totally reverses the vicious incentives that got the healthcare system into this mess in the first place. So stop paying health insurance companies your hard-earned dollars. Go to joincrowdhealth.com now and experience freedom from health insurance. Right now, you can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's almost 50% off the normal price and a lot less than a high-deductible healthcare plan. Just go to joincrowdhealth.com and use promo code WOODS at signup. That's joincrowdhealth.com, promo code WOODS. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. By the way, have you come across any sympathetic, well, I guess you're doing this online, so it's hard to socialize with people, so you can't know if anybody else is thinking the way you are.
So, you're correct. I will say, credit where credit is due, in my undergrad degree, so I went to Texas Christian University for undergrad, go Frogs, and my macroeconomics professor in my undergrad degree actually was a sympathetic ear. He's the reason I found this school of thought altogether. He assigned me Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson, and Thomas Sowell's book, Basic Economics. So I will say, in my master's program, I've yet to see a sympathetic ear. But I don't want to say that all hope is lost. In my finance degree in undergrad, I did find myself with a sympathetic ear who put me on this path and steered me this direction to even know what I was missing out on. So there's absolutely sympathy and hope out there in the world, for sure.
You mentioned to me that you don't hear anything about the Austrian school and that your professors don't seem to know anything about it. But I don't think that's unique to Florida State or to business schools. That's just a general level of societal ignorance, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I remember it first hit me. I hadn't even quoted Mises or Rothbard or even Hayek, who's a little more known. It first hit me when I was writing a paper and I used the words a priori. And my professor wrote me back a note and said, "What is this?" And I remember thinking, you know, a priori is not common day speech. If I had said a priori just out in a conversation, I'd expect my friend to hit me in the face because nobody talks like that. But I also would have expected anyone who's read, honestly, any book by Mises or Rothbard or anyone would have come across that. And I remember just kind of having this red flag in the back of my mind where I was like,
I don't think my professors have read these names even remotely. And as it went on in my school career, I'd start referencing these names and various professors would leave incomparable notes. But this time, rather than just being this little fancy arbitrary word, it'd be in reference to Hayek, who won a Nobel Prize. I'd get a response saying, oh, who is this? I'm not familiar with this person. And it would kind of occur to me a lot of these business school professors probably had one or two economics classes to require their own degrees and kind of stopped with their economics education from there, which I understand and I get. But at the end of the day, when you're really counting on future business people learning, it does sting a little to know that that awareness isn't out in the world. But I also do think you're right. I don't think it's unique to Florida State. I actually think, like you said, Randy Holcomb, we do have at Florida State. I think if anything, Florida State may have it a little better than most just because we do have him. We do have someone having an Austrian whisper here at the school, which is a positive effect to see. So across the board, I think you're right that most schools do encounter that kind of lack of awareness of the Austrian school as a whole.
What do you mean when you say that you think business schools these days are churning out managers rather than entrepreneurs? What's the distinction you're making there?
Well, so I had said that, and again, I also don't want to criticize managers. I think Peter Klein actually has a book coming out about managers or recently came out. I'm blanking in the back of my mind, but managers are an important role in our society. But at the end of the day, when I go through these MBA courses, I see them targeting somebody whose dad owns a company, who's planning on working for a big four accounting firm, who's planning on working for a big finance firm, who's planning on working somewhere that's already well established. And the lessons that we're learning are, look, you've already got the business all set up. Here's how you operate from there. And while I somewhat give that credit, because I mean, it's a master's in business administration. It's not a degree in entrepreneurship. But I think colloquially speaking, when you talk to people who are getting it, I think a significant number of MBA students are doing it because they want to be an entrepreneur, but they kind of don't know exactly where to go with it yet. In fact, before when we agreed to have this conversation, after I gave you that note saying that I think they are trying to train managers as opposed to entrepreneurs, I pulled up some of my class discussion pages from the past few semesters and just made a little Excel sheet tacking off each person in my class who had introduced themselves on the discussion page saying, hi, I hope to go work for Goldman Sachs. Hi, I hope to go start my own business. And more than 50% of the classmates I've encountered were people who really were from the ground up trying to be an entrepreneur and trying to start their own business and really do what Mises would have promoted as an entrepreneur. And at the end of the day, I don't see that as the value you get in an MBA. I'd love to see it start to become that one day. But for now, I think it's much more teaching you how to work at a previously established, well-known business and continue from there.
Once you finish your studies, what are you hoping to do?
So I, for as pessimistic as I come across here talking about universities and whatnot and the Austrian schools they are, my dream is to go get my PhD in economics after I finish my MBA and hopefully down the line be a college professor myself. Like I told you, I was introduced to the Austrian school by my macroeconomics professor. It meant the world to me, and I'd give just about anything to pay that forward to a future budding young business student. And quite frankly, I'd love to just be there and be the professor saying, you know, this is a great class on business, but we can't forget to talk about the business cycle. We can't forget to talk about trade-offs. As great as this textbook is for teaching you how to be a manager, we also need to talk about those of you trying to be entrepreneurs. So my long-term plan, I'd love to be a college professor myself.
Well, I want to have people everywhere, even though some people will say we need to create parallel institutions, which we do, but some people are cut out to infiltrate the existing institutions, and I'm all for that, for there to be a presence. It's like people who say, you should get off YouTube instantly. No, I shouldn't. What's the matter with you? There's a billion people on that thing. Yeah, I know they have stupid, terrible policies, and I might lose my channel anyway, but it's the obverse of people who would say to me, you can't go on Alex Jones's show. Oh, I can't? Why not? Well, because he's a bad guy or I don't agree with him or whatever. He has a gigantic audience. Why can't I talk to them? If he wants me to talk to them, why wouldn't I? So I don't like this shoot yourself in the foot, there's a gigantic audience over here and there's 500 people over there, only talk to the 500. Well, yeah, no wonder we're losing, you know, with that kind of attitude. So I'm all for you doing what will bring you joy. My advice would be that it's going to be tempting when you're in grad school to spend your time blogging and getting involved in day-to-day disputes about items in the news and the economic angle on them. But it would be way, way better to channel that energy into a peer-reviewed journal article, because every grad school kid will have a lot of blog posts when they go on the job market. But they're not really interested in blog posts. But if you have a peer-reviewed journal article, that will put you in the top 10%, if not higher, of your cohort. So, I mean, maybe I'm telling you something you know already, but just in case, that's my advice.
So you're telling me something I know already, and you're telling me something I desperately need to hear, because I can say without a doubt that on some conscious level, I'm aware of that. But I can also say that, you know, when you and I were first connecting and I were sending you my background and what I've written to kind of demonstrate who I am, you can see that everything I've written has been for the Mises Institute, the Libertarian Institute. As much as my brain says, oh, I need to do these other things, you're entirely right that it is tempting to do these things and you fall into that temptation. And I will say off what you were saying about, you know, people who tell you to get off YouTube, get off these other platforms. I found the Austrian School after reading Hazlitt's book. And shortly after, I started Googling around trying to find more about this. And obviously, the Tom Woods Show was one of the first results when I started looking for more information on this. And I can say without a doubt that if you were not on YouTube, I probably wouldn't be sitting in this chair having this conversation today, because I'm one of the bajillion people out there that you've reached because you weren't just sitting on those parallel institutions. That being said, I mean, there are unbelievably great ones out there. All of my real knowledge that I've gained from the blessing of having found the Mises Institute. I don't think there's any better way to learn economics than just going to their store and throwing a dart at whatever you can find. Pulling up their online store. Their Mises University program I went to last year was without a doubt the best thing I've ever experienced in this whole world. If your listeners take one thing from this episode, I want the college-aged libertarians out there, the college-aged economists, to right now go Google Mises University and apply, because as far as parallel institutions go, that is about as good as it gets in this world. They've got their Econ for Business for entrepreneurs. And of course, I mean, you're kind of, despite the fact that you say, okay, obviously I need to stay on these platforms, you're also kind of the king of parallel institutions with the Ron Paul curriculum in the Liberty Classroom. So I really feel my place in wanting to pursue less parallel institutions, but there are just such phenomenal ones out there as well.
Indeed. So my view is to just be everywhere you can possibly be. Be everywhere until they get rid of you, and then be everywhere else that you can be. Is my advice. So I'm glad to hear that you are progressing, you have a goal, that your eyes are open while you're there, and that you're able to, through this program, spread the word about things you've noticed, because these are things that shouldn't be happening. I'll just put it that way. The Acton Institute has a great documentary about the role of the entrepreneur that business school students should see. And yet, unfortunately, they act like even the professors act like you're up to something that polite people don't discuss. It's a real shame. So anyway, best of luck to you, and thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I could not be more grateful for this opportunity.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow on the program, our old friend Andrew Heaton returns. Andrew's a really funny but also brilliant guy. And we're going to talk about a rather unusual topic. We're going to talk about something called international relations theory, which is what you study when you major in international relations, or in the case of Andrew, you have a master's in international relations. And these are schools of thought that we're going to be discussing that try to understand why states come into conflict with each other. And we're going to see if there are things that libertarianism can inform them with and things we libertarians can learn from them. And I'm telling you, Andrew Heaton is the perfect guy for this, because he's smart, articulate, funny, and he knows an awful lot about this crazy stuff. So you want to join me for that tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.